You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
For many millennials, farming is an attractive... Let me start that again. For many millennials, farming is an attractive occupation, one that allows them to live by their principles, do good for the planet and its people, as well as tap into their entrepreneurial spirits. But unlike traditional generational farmers, they often don't have experienced elders to show them the ropes. That is, until now. Stone Barns Center's new book, Letters to a Young Farmer on Food, Farming, and Our Future, is a collection of 36 essays by farmers, chefs, politicians, and writers addressing sustainable farms, meaningful work, the land, climate change, and all sorts of other issues. It's published by Princeton Architectural Press, and I'm pleased that it brings to our show Karen Washington, a farmer activist and co-founder of Black Urban Growers in the Bronx. Brian Richter, the chief scientist for the Global Water Program of the Nature Conservancy. And Jill Eisenbarger, CEO of Stone Barns Center for Food and Agriculture. Welcome to our show.
Thank you,
Leonard.
The essays contributed by farmers make it very clear that if you go into farming, don't expect to get rich. In fact, don't even count on economic security. Well, as someone who hopes to continue to eat good food, I find that very scary. What can we do more to help our farmers other than pay a lot more for our food?
Well,
Jill.
In the 1960s, we spent 17.5% of our income on our food, and now it's 9.9%. So it may not be about paying a lot more, but paying an amount that will support farmers so they can have a dignified career where they make a living wage and have health care is something that we need to think about as a community.
Karen, as a farmer, what could the government do to make your life easier?
Well, especially for the young farmers, help with student loan debt. I think if the government can sort of promise the fact that if young farmers want to farm for 3 or 4 years, that their student loan debt will either be dismissed or lowered. I think there's a lot of young people that want to do it but can't. Their hands are tied because of debt.
So people are not being encouraged to go into farming.
Well, I think they're being encouraged to go to farming. I think the fact is that they have this debt. And so if we can somehow minimize that restraint, then I think more farmers will go into the field.
Well, Barbara Kingsolver, in her essay, talks about how the new U.S. government policy sought to move many people off farms and into cities and industry. The World Bank still defines progress as a shift away from farming and into industrialization. Why has agriculture come to be seen as anti-progress?
Well, I think because people think bigger is better. And so for a fact is that here in the United States, we grow so much food. It's not about a quantity of food. It's the fact that a lot of that food is not going into places that need it the most, which are in low-income neighborhoods.
Now, Brian, Alan Savory says in his letter in this book that American agriculture is at a turning point. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
Well, I certainly hope so. I think that there's a lot of progress that can be made. I think a lot of what the authors in the book were writing about are signals the direction I think we'd like to see a lot of agricultural move. And I think that certainly from my realm, I've been working on water issues and water scarcity issues for 3 decades. And farmers are at the center of that issue because about 70 to 90% of all the water that gets consumed in the world is going to irrigated agriculture. And so in their hands, in those farmers' hands, lies the potential for resolving one of the biggest issues on the planet presently.
It's become a big issue in Central California where people actually, farmers are putting up signs saying, well, do you want to eat or do you want to save the water for something else?
Yes, yes. And that's, the point well taken. But I think there is do you want to eat and can we also use water better? And so one of the things I tried to bring out in my essay is if in irrigated agriculture we could use just a little bit less water, because so much is being used in agriculture, that would free up great volumes of water that could be used to restore our depleted rivers and wetlands, or it could be provided to other people who are desperately in need of more water.
How big is the movement towards sustainability? What percentage of farmland is now sustainable?
Not enough. I mean, Leonard, I wanted to build a little bit on what Brian said in response to your previous question. So I think that a change is going to be forced in agriculture because we're not only living in a world where there's more scarcity, but we're living in a hotter world where we're facing climate change, and we're living in a more open world where people are able to communicate and learn much more quickly and in much more detail about where their food is coming from, how it's grown, who the person is behind that growing. And I think that that is going to activate a whole new kind of consumer movement that will force food to change.
But I get the feeling it's important to nurture young farmers. There are more farmers over the age of 75 than between 30 and 45. And I would assume also that a lot of those older farmers, I don't want to pick on them, but that they have older attitudes, and that the things that you're talking about are more likely to be picked up by younger farmers,
like Karen.
Yeah,
I'd like to add to that, especially for the African-American and people of color movement, farming, the farmers have really, really diminished. And so what we try to do is encourage young farmers of color to think about their ancestral history in terms of agrarian farmers, and really institute the history of growing food, the importance of growing food, that growing food gives you power. And so you're starting to see, especially young people of color, and I sort of addressed this in my letter, starting to understand that when you grow your food, it gives you power. When you are in control of your food system, that gives you power. And so now I'm starting to see young people of color, women, are starting to really enter the food movement.
And I don't think, Leonard, I don't think you can assume that because a farmer's older, they are not advocating for sustainability. And we've seen many, many elders teaching these young people. So Fred Kirschenman, with whom I work very closely, is in his early 80s and was one of the pioneers of organic agriculture in this country.
He says young farmers are motivated to produce food for people and not commodities for the mass market. Mm-hmm. You agree?
Mm. Yes, food has become a commodity. I mean, and hopefully we can keep water out of the system of being a commodity. As long as there is a value, then there's money being made behind that. So we really have to sort of look at our industrial agricultural system with different eyes. And hopefully we can put the emphasis on how do we obtain land and retain land for our future farmers.
At the same time, more than one contributor, including Wendell Berry, asked that readers refrain from passing judgment on farmers who farm conventionally, which is to say, produce commodities for the mass market.
Yeah, I mean, I get really excited about unity amongst farmers, whether they're conventional, organic, sustainable, regardless of how they describe themselves, they're all land stewards and they're all caring for places we care about. And I think working together to drive big change is the only way it's going to happen.
I'm speaking with Jill Eisenberger, CEO of Stone Barn Center for Food and Agriculture, with Brian Richter, the chief scientist for the Global Water Program of the Nature Conservancy, and Karen Washington, a farmer activist and co-founder of Black Urban Growers. They are contributors to a new book called Letters to a Young Farmer on Food, Farming, and Our Future. Marion Nessel writes that to farm sustainably is an inherently political act, a slap in the face of America's industrial agricultural system. And Congresswoman Shelley Pingree describes the return to farming as an important political act. So do you agree that to farm is making a political statement?
Oh, especially for urban growers. Are you kidding? Definitely it's a political statement. When you grow in within cities, especially like New York City, it's very political because there has to be a balance between growing food and development. And so whenever that is placed into the conversation, it is politicized. Right now, we continue in New York City here to fight for the preservation of community gardens as development pops up. I mean, our mayor wants to put at least 200,000 affordable housing units. Again, what affordable means, but again, we have to make sure that those community gardens that are within New York City are protected and preserved.
How big is the area that you farm on?
So my community garden is three quarters of an acre in New York City, the Garden of Happiness.
And how much can you produce in three quarters of an acre?
Well,
and how many different things can you grow?
Well, the thing about it is, which is really, really exciting, we have over 20 members We have 36 boxes, 10 by 15, and most of it is grown by the people that live in the neighborhood. So we're predominantly African-American and Mexican. So we have papalo, papiche, calalo, cilantro, epazote, all the ethnic things that you really couldn't find in a regular grocery store.
Growing them, these things for yourselves, or are you selling them?
Yeah, so we have a farmer's market, the La Familia Farmer's Market, which runs from July to November, giving back to an area of the Bronx which has been deprived access to healthy food.
Alice Waters writes that it's impossible to separate food from the people who grow it and to separate farms from the people who eat the food. So you've just pretty much said the same thing.
Correct.
Do you make a point of knowing who eats your heirloom tomatoes at Stone Barns, because you sell stuff there as well as use what you grow for the restaurant?
Yeah, I feel like one of the most satisfying things for the farmers who work at Stone Barns is being able to have conversation with people about kind of the quality of the food that they're selling them, and do they like it, which tomatoes better, which squash is better. And I think that is really inspirational to keep these young people in the field, that direct link to consumers.
Brian, can sustainable farming feed the American population or the world's population?
Well, I think I better let Jill or Karen answer that question. They've thought about it a lot. But just to respond, you know, from the standpoint of water, you know, we are very concerned about how much water it's going to require to produce the food of the growing global population. And one of the big issues when we talk about trying to save water in irrigated agriculture is this resistance that aren't we going to have to grow more food? But the point that I've tried to make repeatedly, Leonard, is that there really is an opportunity for a true win-win here, that we can actually use considerably less water and increase productivity and increase the revenue generation and grow healthier foods. And so I think there's a lot of positives and there's a lot of room for optimism there.
Sustainable farming, of course, was the norm until, what, about a half century ago or so, a little more than that?
Yeah, pre-World War II.
And then we realized that we had an awful lot of mouths to feed, and so we went in the other direction. Now we're moving back. Can we move back since so much farmland has been lost?
I mean, one of the statistics I love is that we use 30% of our agricultural resources to produce 70% of the world's food. So subsistence farming or sustainable agriculture that is using far fewer resources is feeding an awful lot of people around the planet.
In the New York Times Week in Review this Sunday, Frank Bruni wrote about or against what he called food snobs. Eating locally grown organic food purchased in farmers markets is more expensive than shopping in a grocery store. But is it really all elitist?
Well, for me, it's in terms of the messaging around it. I tend not to use the word, especially in my neighborhood, organic, because what does that mean? What I try to do is to make sure that people at least eat fresh fruits and vegetables first. You know, meet people where they are in terms of getting them to eat healthy first.
Did they hear organic and expensive as meaning the same thing?
Correct, as elitist. And so for me, it's all in the messaging. And the messaging that I like to put out is, you know, let's eat healthy first and let's start with fruits and vegetables and leave the organic versus non-organic out of the equation.
My guests are, we have to take a little break. We'll be back with more. My guests are Karen Washington, who is a farmer, an activist, and co-founder of Black Urban Growers in the Bronx. Brian Richter, the chief scientist for the Global Water Program of the Nature Conservancy. And Jill Eisenberger, CEO of Stone Barns Center for Food and Agriculture. And they are all contributors to a book called Letters to a Young Farmer on Food, Farming, and Our Future. It is published by Princeton University Press, Princeton Architectural Press. Oh, I'm sorry, although I don't know, is there much about architecture in this book? Well, we're building for the future. We will continue after this. We are back with three of the contributors, the many contributors to a new book called Letters to a Young Farmer on Food, Farming, and Our Future. It's published by Princeton Architectural Press. with us are Karen Washington, Brian Richter, and Jill Eisenbarger. And we have a listener who's calling in who was inspired by this conversation to ask a question. George from Clifton, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Thank you so much for taking my call.
Go ahead.
My question is this. I have a young teenage daughter, and at one time she expressed some interest in interning at a aeroponics college. It's in Newark, New Jersey. Unfortunately, they wouldn't take her because of her age, but it kind of started on the question for me. What do farmers, conventional farmers, actually think of hydroponic technology, aeroponic technology, things basically farming that's not done in soil?
Yes, for me, there's room for everyone. I mean, for me, it's all about sustainable practices. So you have farmers that are doing hydroponics and aquaponics. If this is something that she's interested in, just go for it. I just take a view to make sure that it's sustainable and that it's rooted in social and food justice.
Is it as nutritionally is it nutritionally similar to things that are grown in the soil?
I'm going to be more partial to growing in the soil, but leave that up to the experts that do that.
But sometimes you have no choice in the matter.
Well, and one thing I wanted to mention, Leonard, is that, you know, it's a little bit counterintuitive. When you say you're growing plants in water, hydroponics, you would think that it's going to be, you know, much more water intensive. And it's actually the reverse is true, that it's actually more efficient to grow water in a hydroponic situation simply because of the care and attention that you're giving to the growing process. And I think that extends across all of what we're talking about with sustainable agriculture, is that the more closely you're paying attention to what's going on and what the crops need, the less resource intensive it's going to be.
Jill, many chefs are forming direct relationships with farmers. What role does taste play in promoting sustainable farming?
It may be the number one thing that leads to change. I think that taste really gets people excited about thinking about where their food came from. Why does one carrot taste better than the other? And I want more of the one that tastes better. And if I can identify that that was grown sustainably, that will be something that helps me to make change. And we're really, really interested in the conversations between chefs and farmers, because we need chefs who are excited about using all of the ingredients that you need to grow on a farm to cultivate healthy soils. So the nitrogen fixers, some of the grains that maybe aren't such a mainstay in our diet, and chefs are going to help us figure out how to make that stuff delicious.
And they also encourage farmers to grow things that they might not have grown otherwise, and then those things become available to the rest of us.
Yeah. Fun. It's fun.
I think also chefs are not only looking at sort of the taste of food, but also seasonality, I think, is really, really important. I know on our farm, some of the chefs even, so I have a 3-acre farm called Rise and Root up in Chester, New
York. Oh,
you have
another farm?
Yes, I do.
Outside of the Bronx.
Yes, Rise and Root Farm. And so one thing that is really fun is that chefs even like our weeds. So purslane, dandelion leaves, and even lamb's quarter are something that chefs really go after.
But isn't full-time farming your second career? You're a physical therapist.
I was a physical therapist. I retired in 2014, and now I am fulfilling my passion. So for any of you out there in the audience, go for it. Dream big.
Tell us about Black Urban Growers, or it's funny, Bugs.
Bugs, correct. That was started back in 2010 when a lot of us were starting to come more involved in a food movement. But when we looked at the landscape, we didn't see a lot of farmers that looked like us. And in New York State, where they had 55,000 white farmers, only 112 were Black. And so what we're trying to do is just sort of engage in a conversation of trying to get more people of color into the food movement and to understand their history around food and farming.
Yeah, but as someone who has promoted urban farming since 1985, encouraging people with no prior experience to start growing food is kind of old hat for you. What advice would you give to a listener who dreams of leaving corporate life to start a sustainable farm?
Follow your dream. I tell people, if this is your passion, this is something that you want to do. One of the recommendations I always say from time to time again, if you're a farmer and you think you're an expert, you're wrong. Because the only expert is Mother Nature, because you can grow the best crops one year, and then the second year, if Mother Nature is not agreeing with you, it could be disastrous. So go out and try. Get your hands dirty. Enjoy the connection that you have between your life and the environment and the earth.
And isn't that something that's affected the recent weather this year and last year? I gather last year there were no peaches or apricots in the Hudson Valley because February had been so warm. I don't know what's going to happen this year. Once again, February was warm and it was also cold. We had to wait for March to really get February weather. But does that mess things up? Aren't the apple blossoms already popping up in Washington?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely does. And weather is a huge challenge. It makes the risk of agriculture incredible. But yeah, these trees blossom and then they freeze and then they can't fruit. And so as a farmer, you can lose your whole crop in the matter of a few days in February or March.
So you have to grow things that you know will survive the winter, although...
And keep your fingers crossed.
And diversity.
Yeah, and it was 5 degrees above zero the other day, and then suddenly it's 50.
Yeah.
And we're really seeing these bigger and bigger swings in the water availability. So, you know, as we've all been hearing about California and the Colorado River Basin out in the west, they're experiencing droughts like they've never had in recorded history before. And I think as much as making sure that the crops are appropriate for the region that you're growing them in, is farmers are getting, they're learning to adapt at hyperspeed now because they have to. They're getting thrown, you know, curveballs that they've never seen before.
With global warming, Karen, do you think you'll be growing avocados soon and oranges?
Well, I think Brian makes a good point because I think a lot of us are changing the practice, really trying to grow now drought-resistant seeds and plants. Also looking more in terms of cover cropping, composting, a lot of ways to conserve what he's absolutely right. That's going to be a challenge in the near future.
Let's take a call. Kate from Astoria. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah. My husband and I, we live in New York City. We're environmental educators. We have two young children. My husband's a beekeeper. We've worked in botanical gardens and zoos here in the city. It's our dream to settle down someplace not too far upstate and start a small sustainable farm. But for us, we really haven't been able to save the collateral that we know is necessary for having an economically secure life for our kids. So I'm just curious if your board can talk a little bit about some resources for young people who are looking to get into sustainable farming, but don't necessarily have the money to get started the way they'd like to. And I'll have to take my comments off the air. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you for calling, Kate.
I mean, the state of New York is starting some really interesting programs to help people with the entry costs for buying land. And we work directly with the state to practice agriculture on one of their state park preserves. So one of the things that gives me hope that will be helpful to young people is that people are getting very creative about how we can create more land access for agriculture. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But it's not just cost of land. Young farmers also face the cost of equipment, the lack of family members and neighbors who they can go to seek advice from, and also just the rising cost of property.
Right
now, is there any affordable farmland within 50 miles of New York City?
I mean, I think the cost of land is a huge percentage of those challenges. But you mentioned equipment. There's some really creative...
You can share equipment, I guess.
Yeah, you can share equipment. Extension sometimes will lease equipment. So what I see happening is these regional food networks and agricultural networks are just starting to be rebuilt. And slowly but surely, more resources for sharing and appreciation from the community and support from the community is making this a more accessible profession.
Karen, haven't you thrown in your lot with some other farmers?
Yes, so
at Rise and Root Farm?
Right, so I'm at the Agricultural Center, which is up in Chester, New York, which is a brand new venture. So we're able to lease our land, which is very, very affordable. And we share a lot of the equipment. New farmers have to be somewhat inventive. We started with crowdfunding in terms of really helping with the cost of a lot of our equipment. And so sharing resources. Also, there are farmers out there that are getting old and they're willing to lease out their land. I would advise the couple to just go and go on a farm trip. That's what we did in the very beginning. We went up and down the Hudson Valley asking questions. There are farmers that are willing to either lease their land or they're old enough and they want to retire. So I would not sort of look at that as something negative. Just go out there and...
Wouldn't that be sharecropping?
No, hopefully it would not be.
Calling Ben Carson.
Please, I don't start that. I just, you know, I woke up this morning and I said, I'm in a different country. I guess we're talking about the fact that he called slavery, us as black people, immigrants. I think he needs to really relive his history.
Land trusts are a great resource too, Leonard. So a lot of young farmers we work with have worked with their local land trust and they have helped them seek out access to land.
And there's some really interesting partnerships developing that are sort of unexpected relationships. For example, my organization, the Nature Conservancy, has been doing a lot of work in western states like Texas, where historically on some of the farms, the use of water has dried up the creeks and dried up some of the streams. And in our interest to try to restore nature, we're now acquiring some of these properties that are going out because some of the farmers are retiring and getting out of the business. And we're picking up some of those properties and inviting young farmers to come in because we know that what they're going to grow and how they're going to grow it is going to be much more efficient from a water standpoint. And by using less water on those farms that historically used a lot of water, some of that water then will remain in the stream and those streams will come back to life, which is wonderful.
Every essay in the book talks about the hard work of farming and the never-ending tasks. Why is farming so appealing to some people? Is it
it's the fact that you're back in nature, you're putting your hands in the ground. And for me and a lot of my friends, it's a spiritual sort of connection of coming back to the land and having that one-on-one experience with your environment that makes it so, so beautiful. At the end of the day, don't get me wrong, you're tired, you're beat, but you can sit back and look at what you've done. Look across the landscape and see what you've done with your hands and really appreciate that connection.
And then, of course, when you go and pick something fresh and then cook it for dinner, that doesn't make you feel bad either.
Icing on the cake.
Doesn't get any better than that.
David from White Plains, you're on the air.
Leonard, thank you. My name is David Yaffe. I'm the dean at Pace Law School in White Plains. And I'm enjoying your show very much today. I wanted to let you know that we recently started a clinic, a law clinic, for small farmers and small food producers who are doing sustainable agriculture or sustainable food production. A lot of these are, you know, two-person, three-person operations. They don't have a lot of funds for lawyers. Our clinic, which is supervised by a very experienced lawyer and staffed by students, provides free legal help, both business type stuff, so leases and partnership agreements and incorporating your business, and also help with the regulations. This is a very, very heavily regulated area, and we can help guide people through the thicket.
And so much of the language of farming, inputs, yields, planning, marketing, is the language of business. Mm-hmm. So farmers have to think of themselves as business people as well. Mm-hmm.
100% they do. And, you know, what we have seen, we just opened our doors in January. We're doing this in partnership with NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council. I know you're well familiar with their work. And we've had a ton of inquiries from clients and potential clients because, like I said, these are small operations. They often have a pretty good business plan. In other words, whether they, you know, are sophisticated about the spreadsheets and the terms you were using, they've got an idea for product. They know what it'll cost them to produce it, and they know what they can sell it for. But dealing with, you know, whether it's the State Department of Agriculture or the FDA or this in New York City, the City Health Department, you know, that's something they just have zero experience in, and that's where a law clinic can be of help.
David, your Margot Pollins from the law clinic came to the National Young Farmers Conference at Stowe Barns, and she was advising people on everything from regulations related to slaughter to land purchasing to how they structured a business. Was it an LLC or what was the right legal structure? And it's an incredible, incredible resource.
Thanks for your call. Steve from Westchester, you're on the air.
Thanks, Leonard. I'm curious about the Nature Conservancy's work indigenously in third world countries with snow melt and glacial melt. whether there's much work going on predictive losses of livelihood around the world.
Yes, thanks for asking. It's a very, very big concern. And there are many communities and even entire cultures that are dependent upon glacial melt in different parts of the world, indigenous peoples, as well as, you know, other folks that have been there for hundreds, if not thousands of years. One of the things that we're trying to do is to make sure that that those populations have appropriate entitlement and access to water. That's very, very important, because in a lot of the both the developing and the industrialized areas of the world, when the rights or the allocation to use water were doled out, a lot of the poor and indigenous peoples missed out on that for various reasons: illiteracy, not understanding the rules, not being able to travel to the filing locations, and that sort of thing. And so one of the things that organizations like ours can do is to try to rectify some of those wrongs, try to ensure in everything that we do that everybody everywhere has adequate access to clean water.
Let's take one more call. Robert from Monroe, New Jersey, you're on the air.
Hi, Lenny. Another excellent show. I was hoping your guests could talk about technology in the 21st century and farming, so that maybe the way we're producing food today is not the way we'll do it tomorrow, such that we'll have total control of the environment by maybe doing vertical farming in skyscrapers, where insects and weather will be another thing of the past. We'll control the total environment, and also that recently there's been an experimentation with 3D printing, where literally they're by molecule producing food exactly to what we want. And they've recently produced a hamburger.
Yeah, but
very tasty, but
I remember 30 years ago or so on this show, when I first started doing it, we talked about vertical farming. I haven't seen any vertical farms in those 30 years. Is that something that's been happening?
Yeah, Steve Ritz is a person that's really doing a lot of vertical farming in classrooms. He's really known throughout the region in terms of vertical farming. It's in terms of technology, I think technology will really be helpful in terms of preserving our seed bank and making sure that seeds are preserved so that we can grow food. My biggest challenge is the fact that seeds are being modified and being patented. And for me, as a human being, I feel that seeds should not be patented. Somehow we need to preserve the context of our genetic seeds.
Jill, the chef at Blue Hill at Stone Barns, yeah. Dan Barber, has started a whole project called Wasted.
Uh-huh.
And that's another way of taking care of these problems. He is finding ways, sort of suggested by our last caller also, doing tasty food from the things that we normally throw away.
What's so great about what he's doing is he's looking deep into the supply chain. So he's looking for places where there's a lot of waste. So like a fish processing center where a third of the fish ends up on the floor when they're filleting it. How do we use that third of the fish? One other great thing
the
that's happening. Pulp from juicers to make a pulp burger. One other great thing that's happening with technology at Stone Barns is we have a program called Slow Tools. And we have recruited engineers and designers and really forward-looking people who are working on technology to think about how they can make small-scale agriculture more efficient. How do they create ergonomic tools using the best technologies of today to help advance agriculture at a small scale?
Daniel from Pennsylvania, you're our last caller.
Hi, how you doing?
Go ahead.
I'm a young farmer that took that leap. I was a professional chef for about 15 years, hobby farming for the last five. And as that hobby grew and my love for agriculture grew, I decided to go all in. And I left my cushy corporate executive chef position. And for the last 2 years, I've been full-time farming.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Spread the love.
Yeah, and I sell my products to Michelin star restaurants in Manhattan, and I've created a considerable network here in the Lehigh Valley that I get different products from, and I sell into New York.
And so, what was the hardest part of the transition, Daniel?
Well, it was just that that one decision to say do it. Right. I would say that would be the hardest.
But we're seeing a number of chefs. So the Satter Farms in Long Island also is the man who used to be the chef at Lutèce. So I guess a number of chefs have been inspired to go into farming. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but my great thanks to the three of you for being on our show. Jill Eisenberger, CEO of Stone Barn Center for Food and Agriculture. Karen Washington, farmer activist and co-founder of Black Urban Growers in the Bronx, also a farmer in Orange County, is it?
In Chester, New York, at Rise and Root Farm.
And Brian Richter, the chief scientist for the Global Water Program of the Nature Conservancy. They're all contributors to a new book from Princeton Architectural Press called Letters to a Young Farmer on Food, Farming, and Our Future.